kill him or put him in the jail forever. So he bent down and crept slowly out from under the privy and broke through the space between two of the men. He was grinning in the dark. Their hands were busy holding up the privy. There were no hands to stop him. He ran away from them and broke through the hedge between the houses. He could pretend he was not Abel, but some other deaf. He was grinning more widely, and when he stopped, he began to laugh. It was very cold. He stood, signing wide in the blind night, telling himself the joke of it. "I do not like you in my house, lady fat with a baby. If you do not get out of here, I will move my house away and leave you sitting on the stool in your night clothes." All around him was safe darkness and numbing cold. The cold was so hard it hurt him to breathe, and the stars scratched where God put them to help it be night. No one ever told him about what they were made of, stars, or where they were in the daytime. There were really people who knew things like that. World things. Hearing knew things like that. But he skipped the word off his forefinger, playing. "Hearing do not know how to catch deafs in privies." When he got back to the room, Janice was sleeping. She lay curled over the lump of her middle so it was hidden, and she looked almost the same as when they were first married. Her face had some of its old fullness, and there was the uncareful, not mute look she had once. Maybe there would be trouble because of his making noise in the privy. He sighed and began to undress, and suddenly found himself blind with tears. "My dear son and daughter-in-law, this is just to let you know we are holding like we were. The white mare we had when you were home has foaled. We received your Christmas greetings, which has been put on the mantel. Tarvis Elder come by and seen it. Your father was against me writing this, as he feels what is put in words makes a thing come to pass. Everyone says to send greetings to you, which I am doing. Your loving mother." Abel said, "We have to write to them to tell them about the baby." "I don't want to tell anything now. What if something happens and then we will end up back there on the farm?" "We need to tell them soon there will be a baby. But if they know, my mother might come here. She will find out about the court." They decided to write a letter and also to put off writing it for a while, so it was easy to wait until June, when Janice came home early one afternoon and lay down, grinding her teeth and groaning, and began to have her baby. When Abel came home, the landlady met him in the hall and told him, mouth, gestures, looks, and writing, what had happened. She showed how she had called a midwife, pointing to a sour-faced woman at the top of the stairs. Both the women were angry that nothing was done or ready except a few hemmed cloths. They had to use newspapers, they said, which slid. She, gesturing to the room, didn't know a thing about having a baby. She fought them and thrashed here and there. She wouldn't open her legs. She wouldn't lie quietly, turning and fighting until they thought she would kill herself. And then... He ran up the stairs. The room was angry with chaos and the smell of blood. A hanging animal odor he remembered from the farm. And another smell he remembered but could not name. Newspapers lay over the bed, and at first he couldn't see anything else. The two women came in behind him and stood like law in the corners. Abel looked and looked at the bloody bed until he made out something lying among the papers and ruined sheets. As he went to it, the landlady began to gesture at him, moving her mouth, blah, blah, ma, blah, blah, which he couldn't read because of fear. He turned from her again to the heap and went to it and began to shake it. The midwife got up and pulled at him. The heap moved under his hands, hair falling away from what came to be a face. Eye in the face opened. It was his Janice. She was alive. The landlady pulled him back then and began again at him. Blah, ma, ba. He did not go to the bother of reading it. At last, she got a pencil and paper and wrote down what she wanted to tell him. Since the mother was a dummy and had fought them and worn them out, the fee would be $15 for the midwife and $10 for her. The bedclothes, which were ruined even with all they tried to do, would come to another $2.50. He read the paper, nodding slowly. Only then did he think that he hadn't seen a baby. He made the sign for baby, and they took him around the bed and showed him where a basket was on the floor. In the basket was a wrinkled red puppet, alive, its fists working, its eyes shut tight like any animal just born, world-surprised and disliking. Even as he watched it, it breathed. The midwife raised the edge of one of Janice's hemmed squares to show its swollen female sex, and Abel saw the cord end and the blood-streaked belly. The landlady was back to writing again. Abel thought that maybe he could give her the baby for all the money it took to get it out of Janice, but he didn't know how to say it, so he just stood and waited until the landlady gave him what she had written. He got dizzy and had to sit down to read it. She wanted all that money now. She wanted them to move, too. The room was not for three. When his wife woke up, the writing said, give her coffee. Yes, she knew they made it in here. Put the baby to the breast when it cried. She wanted the money by tomorrow at the latest. If not, she would get the law on them. She and the other one left. He began to make coffee, and then he collected the wet and bloody papers and stuffed them in the stove. They would stink to burn, too. Janice woke up. I have a baby, she said, and began to look over the mess on the bed for it. He showed her the basket. Is she all right? Yes, the woman said to give it milk from you. I didn't like them. That other one slapped and punched me. They want money. They want money tomorrow, or they will call the court and throw us in the jail. And we have to leave here.
Is the baby all right? Is it going to live? How can I get that money?
Maybe I will have to go to Mr. Webendorf because I don't have that much.
Is it hearing?
Who hears?
Is the baby a hearing?
Sure.
How do you know?
Born in newspaper. Born in all the words.
When it came to be night, Abel turned on the light and saw the baby was awake. He went to it, but he did not know how to help it, so it scared him and he turned away. Janice was asleep again, but her face still remembered the smile it had had before. Sometimes he wondered what laughing sounded like. In school, many people had ideas about how different things sounded, and some of them could hear talk if it was loud enough. Sometimes he wondered about the sounds of things. Anyway, laughing was gone now, and so were the strangers, hearing, who had been in the room and had punched Janice when he wasn't there. The old way was gone, too. It was gone with those hearing. What if this baby they left was hearing? In his mind, he saw it grown, not to a person, but only itself, very big. He thought he could never be able to speak to it. Hearing are the strangers, hearing never understand. Then he thought, maybe it is not a hearing anyway. Maybe it is only a deaf, like us.
As they sat up, tired and frightened, Janice told Abel about the money. There were things to get for the baby. Diapers and caps and bands, and money was needed for the landlady and the other one who came. Still frightened, she told him it was special Christmas money which she saved to surprise him. Most of his own secret bonus money had already been spent on food. He found he couldn't go on the coffee and bread she gave him for breakfast, and only bread and apple for lunch. On bad days, he also took the streetcar home. He had $4 saved. He was angry that she had not told him about her bonus, had saved it away and not told him and let him worry about where the baby money was coming from. The night passed without sleep. Their fear lay open-eyed and watching, its odor heavy in the shadows of the room. They kept a candle lit because they were afraid the baby might cry. Abel tried to doze for a while, but the fear would bristle somewhere in warning, and he would shoot up in the bed, sweating and strange, not knowing for a moment where he was. Janice didn't have any milk, only some clear drops from her breast, and she was frightened that the child would die before morning. Abel stayed home the next day because he was too tired to work and because Janice needed to sleep while he watched. The baby was dying of hunger and no milk came. When Janice slept, she saw the baby dying and saw them in the court and in the jail because they did not pay for it.
She became so frightened that she woke crying and shaking and would not go back to sleep again until she could have her hand on the baby's body. In the end, it was the way she felt the baby's cry, and they were able to sleep. Crying shook the baby's body, and that shaking brought Janice awake in an instant, full of fear. She kept trying to nurse the child all the time, but there were still only those drops. Not clear now, but like the white cord in an egg. And the baby didn't seem to be learning how to suck hard enough. When Abel was sleeping, Janice got up and went and took out the bonus money from the suitcase. When she gave it to him the next morning, it seemed very much, but the woman wanted $27.50. And there was the rent and another place to move to, and in the end, it was very little money. All those weeks and weeks of bonus, very little. They waited until the evening, and then Abel took the money to the landlady. While he was gone, Janice began to think of a name for the baby, and she thought it should be called Margaret Ryder. Someone in school once told her that Margaret was a very good name. When Abel came back, he said, "She wants us to move away. Baby cries."
"Where? Where can we go?"
"She says we can stay until the end of the month."
"I want to move to Burrard Street."
It was where they had walked in the summer, where the white painted houses were, and the porches big and cool, and the trees that touched branches over the streets. "We will move near work," he said. "Moody Street, Bisher, someplace around there. Soon. We have to find a place soon. After I gave her the money, she wrote I must give something to Mr. Webendorf and everyone at work. I have to give them cigars."
"You saw her mouth wrong. That can't be right."
"She wrote it. She laughed, but not in the bad way. She is sure."
"Do you think it is true?"
"Maybe it is some joke against us." "Maybe it is some little law. I think maybe it's a way like Christmas."
"Maybe they will laugh at us for it."
Abel's eyes went away from her face, puzzled. Then he smiled and nodded.
"Yes, I remember.
Pickard on the linotype in the shop, he did it once. You give cigars to others, they shake your hand and laugh."
"How many, then?"
7.
"How much does cigars cost?"
"How much is possible?"
"I don't know. For all of them? Is it something you must do?"
"If I don't, it will be too deaf."
"Tomorrow," she said, "you can use the rest of the money of the suitcase."
He went back to work the next day. He went early, hoping she did not see the relief he felt getting out of the close room and the always and everything of baby. He stopped at a small tobacco shop and was surprised at how much cigars cost. He remembered then that Pickard didn't just hand a cigar to each man. He had held out a full box and allowed each man to take one or more, according to his ways. A full box, even the cheapest, cost what a week's dinners cost. Abel stood in the store trying to get the box and go. He was too angry to do anything but wait for the anger to leave him. The store man stood with hands hovering among the boxes, also waiting. The law had its rule. The trade, its demands. At last, he sighed, went forward, and pointed to one of the boxes. The man nodded and wrapped up the bright-colored box with its beautiful foreign lady. Abel found himself sweating a kind of cold inside his coat because of the cost. Later at work, when he got up from lunch, he went from man to man as Pickard had done. He made a sign and found that hearing understood that cradle arm sign for baby. The men hit him on the back and laughed as they had done with Pickard. They took the cigars by ones and twos, sniffing and lighting one up and putting the other into a pocket for later. As he moved down the floor, the news went ahead of him, and men turned to him, smiling. It gave him, to his own surprise, a shy pride. Janice lay on the bed, trying to rest. The room made her nervous because of all the clothes and rags and boxes piled up, and the drying things that were hung here and there. The smell of mess in the diapers was strong in the room, and the soft rags in the basket were beginning to smell bad. The landlady had given her a bucket to scrub them in, but she would have to carry it down to the wash tub in the basement or outside in the back. She would have to take the baby, too, lest it wake alone and cry. She didn't feel strong enough to do this work. Even thinking about it made it heavier. She wanted to be walking in the fresh air, away from the bad smell and the tightness in her that made her want to curse the walls. Before noon, the landlady put her head in and told Janice that there was something for which she had to come downstairs. Down, jabbing her finger many times for Janice to understand. It was hard to believe. Janice didn't know if she had understood since there was no one who knew her, and nothing but work to leave the room for, but the landlady kept motioning to come. So she pulled on an old work smock she had taken with her from the school. The careful chain stitch, State School of Deaf and Blind on the front, had been as carefully pulled out, but its outline, less faded, still remained. Janice checked Margaret, sleeping in the basket, looked at her own pale stranger's face in the mirror, gathered her hair and put a string around it, and then picked her way carefully down the stairs. There was a tall man there. His back was to her as she came into the front room. He was looking at the irises in the yard. They were purple with fat stems and big flags. She didn't like those flowers. In a minute, the man turned around and smiled at her, and his mouth said, "Mrs. Janice Ryder?" She nodded.
"Hey, old baby."
She nodded, unsure.
"I, for the bill."
"What?" she said. "What are you, eh?"
"I aim for the bill."
She fainted. Afterwards, she could not understand, coming awake back in the room on the bed. The landlady was sitting on the chair, cleaning her nails. Her look was bad, angry and impatient. When Janice tried to sit up, the woman motioned with her head to something beside her on the pillow, and then got up and went out. It was a note.
"Dear Mrs. Ryder, I am sorry if I caused you any trouble or gave you a shock. Your landlady told me you were deaf, which I was not told at the mill. I am from the union at the mill, and I want to help you if you plan to come back to work. We have some help for working mothers. If you are interested, please come to the union office at 52 Bisher Street."
At the bottom was his name. Janice closed her eyes and began to tremble a little. It was Mill, he had said, not Bill. Maybe. Maybe nothing about a bill. She began to cry without knowing why she was crying or how she could stop. She was still crying when the landlady came in again with a note, and as she left, she pointed angrily at the basket. In it, the tiny baby was red and bent up with its own howling. It was wet and messed, with its greenish-yellow mess pushing from the rims of the small rag diaper. Janice got up groaning and tended to it. More work for the evening and Abel's wash and her own. She put the baby to her breast and felt a small prickling as its mouth began to move there. Something was starting. The baby had begun to pull, and at the other breast, Janice saw a large whitish drop forming. It hung on the nipple for a moment, and then fell on the faded cloth of the smock. There was another drop, and then another. She felt embarrassed, as if someone were watching. She was surprised at the suddenness of it, embarrassed at the plenty, afraid at the waste. She felt a long, slow drawing, low, where the baby had come from, and then a tightening of her breasts. They were, in some mysterious way, a part of each other. And this new thing was a part of something more. And she was now in the rhythm of it as surely as giving cloth to the machine. 6 hours later, the baby really began to nurse. Milk flowed, real milk, and then the child drank, the womb drew, the rhythm rose in the web of nerves and muscles to make itself known, and the same rhythm spread to the child who lay in it, wrapped and held by it, sucking and breathing. The pulses in the little temples and the soft top of the head moved strong and sure in their beat at the limits of the rhythm. She could see that rhythm, touch it. Deaf or not, the echo was sounding in her flesh and in the child. When the baby was satisfied and lay sleeping, Janice studied the landlady's note.
"I told your husband I couldn't let you stay here no more. Please find yourselves a place. You can keep the basket and bedding for the baby, but get it washed soon. The union man carried you up to bed, and I don't want none of that around here either, so leave by the end of this week.
They had to use their deafness carefully, smiling and misunderstanding, smiling and forgetting and misunderstanding, so that they had an extra week while they looked for a place, climbing dozens of flights of stairs and staring into room after room of dim, sour apartments. At last, Abel found a place. It was over an empty store on a long street, and it was near the mill. The street was so crowded with business and people that he thought it must be at the very middle of the city. He thought Janice would like the crowds and movement, and he was sure she would like the two rooms he had gotten. There were only two other apartments over them. The street was called Vandalia Street. Abel did not know that to live on Vandalia Street was to be known automatically as an immigrant, one of a howling polyglot swarm that had flowed into the crumbling slums by the river to take up its generation of the golden dream. Vandalia Street's lofts seethed with roaches, its corners winked with rats, and there wasn't a policeman for a mile. Its houses were fire traps. Its rents were high, but Abel was lucky to get rooms so close to the print shop and the mill. There wouldn't be the torment of long walks in the winters, and the landlord seemed pleased when he found out that his new tenants were deaf.
Good. Deaf and dumb won't be no noise. No loud parties. Good.
But they had no furniture, and to pay the rent on the two rooms, Janice would have to get back to work very soon. Before she had the baby, the section foreman at the mill had written down that when she was ready to work, she could come back and ask for something called home piecework. As soon as she was strong enough, she and Abel went to see the nice union man who tried to help her before. It surprised them when the union man showed great anger about this piecework. He told them that it was evil and an explosion of working people. Janice answered, writing back that she was experienced and a bonus and knew her machine. She was not going to do evil with it and would run it good and faster than any girl. When he shook his head and waved her paper away, she wrote that she understood his thought. I know. I saw many time girl hurt because careless. The electrical of machines sometimes to come with blue sparks, but this is because wire is old. We'll be very careful home. He tried to tell her about the home piecework system. He wrote that it was a kind of slavery, with rates set so low that it doomed the worker to 2 days of work just to pay for the rental of machines. Janice and Abel looked at each other in wonder. That meant 5 other days, long, full days to earn for themselves alone, and at home, too. She could nurse and care for Margaret and need less money for coats and hats and overshoes. They left the angry union man and went to the mill where Janice signed her name at the new section. She was pleased to see that there were new machines, that they were made without any cords. She said quickly to Abel, "Pedals, no electrical, no danger of exploding working people." After dark, Janice and Abel brought the machine to their new place, wrapped in a blanket to hide what it was. The union man had been very angry. Suppose the machines were not allowed by some law. Maybe there was something in the law against their using this expensive thing when Abel owed so much money already for something bought yet not bought and sold but not sold. It was better if no one found out about the machine. It stood gleaming and powerful in the back room, the only piece of furniture there. They moved their clothes and the baby, smiling as they came into the new place again, and saw the secret thing that was waiting for them in the second of two rooms. On the first evening after supper, Abel stayed sitting on the floor. In front of him was his cigar box with the beautiful foreign lady, and now he was using it to hold his important papers. With the box to lean on, he wrote to his parents, "We have a baby. It is a girl named Margaret Ryder. Now we move 1522 Vandalia Street." He folded the letter and put it in the box until he could get to the post office for a stamp and envelope. He saw the city map in the box, took it out and unfolded it. It was the one he and Janice used for their walks last summer. He thought he would tape it to the wall with some printer's stripping tape, like a picture, because now they were living in Section 3, near the lower middle of the city. He turned and asked Janice where she wanted to walk this Sunday. Their summer had almost begun.
Only a little, she said. I feel tired because of the baby and we will have to carry her.
Let's go back to where we went last summer, where the nice houses are. We can take her with us.
I can't fit into my dress and I don't have anything nice to wear.
As soon as we get some money. I can work Sundays now. I am starting my fourth year soon and there will be some extra money.
All day Sunday, she said, to work for the time I have to take with the baby.
I want to go to many streets and places this summer, in this section,
and I can work at night, too, she said. They still have bonus for work above the quota.
She was staring at the machine and the pile of cutout caps. She had been looking at it ever since dinner, eager, he saw, to use it. To turn the big, shining wheel, to begin to give thread and cloth to it, to let the feeding take everything into its rhythm until it ate away the great pile in the slow, steady eating. He did the same with jog and jog of paper, filling and emptying bale and cradle with the spring-wound foot delicately, like a finger made wet on the tongue, pushing paper after paper under the rollers. He knew that the rhythm had a kind of wish to follow itself, a force to repeat nothing more than itself endlessly. And of course, each layer of the great pile of cut cloth into so many and so many caps was a penny or two or five, adding as the pile was lessened. He wondered why the union people were so angry about the piecework. They had made reasons and nonsense reasons. Hearing had nothing else but reasons. They went blibber-blobber with their mouths all day, and the reasons ran out and into the court and into the law, and it all went running out like blood, and you had to go and pay for invisible cars and invisible reasons. Janice's eyes were on the machine again. He took his finger away from the map where it was pointing to a little park in the corner of the second section.
Go work, he said, feeling annoyed with her. Get it ready to sew if you want.
The mill had even given her a table on which to set the machine, and she arranged a cardboard box they had found in an alley to take the flow of work from one side to the other. She tried the fruit crate she had brought up for a chair and then threaded the machine and checked the bobbins one-handed, while the other hand pulled the first piece under. He stared at her in a slow wonder, never having seen her so wise and serious. She knew everything about the machine. Here she tightened, there she eased, her fingers going surely in their swift, clean motions. Then the gleaming wheel was pushed, the patterned piece caught up and in, pleated and folded with a blind hand, the vibration of the machine humming in the floor and up through his bones. In her basket in a corner, Margaret moved. Abel saw the spasm of her movement and went over to see, then back to stand over the machine.
Baby is crying.
Reluctantly, the machine stopped. The hands came up.
I nursed her an hour ago.
Anyway.
Janice got up and went to the basket.
Not crying now.
Back at the machine, she started the wheel, sucking her cheek, impatient to take up the torn rhythm and seal it once more. The machine began. In the corner, the baby kicked and cried, and Abel picked it up and brought it closer. It only howled more. He stopped Janice again, and she looked up in irritation.
Someone, Abel said slowly, and with a kind of empty calm, someone in this room is hearing everything.
6. The ground tone of Margaret's childhood was her mother's machine. It was the sound of the family life, and it paused only for the few moments necessary to eat or go to the hall bathroom. By its speed and tone, Margaret learned her mother's moods, and when a needle broke and had to be replaced, the minutes of waiting rang in the awful silence with terrible length. It was as though a living thing had stopped breathing, and the watchers waited desperately for breath to come again and save it from death. On Sundays, Abel forced the machine to this horrible waiting silence, and they all took a walk, Janice grumbling and scowling through the strange, unwilling ritual. When Bradley was born, the machine stopped for a day and a half, and so awful was the silence then that Margaret banged the floor and cried in terror, and went into the machine again and again to stroke its black metal neck and beg it to save her mother's life. Only when she heard the comforting click-tick monotone whir whine again was the family safe, the house alive, the world without terror. They were a closed family, a family of habit, and their habits measured each day and each week without change. Every evening at the same time, Margaret's father would come home and go immediately to the sink to use the special pumice soap he kept there. Not even that soap could get all the ink out of the lines of his hands, but every day he scrubbed, rinsed, and scrubbed again. Then he would nod at the back room where Janice nodded a greeting back, the machine not slowing. Then he would sit down and take out his cigarette paper and tobacco and roll himself a cigarette with great care. He smoked slowly with long, fine expressions of leisure. And while he smoked, he did nothing else. By the time the cigarette was finished, the machine would have begun to slow and then it would stop. And Janice would come in and begin to put out the dinner things. During this time, Abel talked to Margaret, asking her if she had had a nice day. Margaret always answered his questions seriously and with dignity, and she always said she enjoyed the day whether she did or not. It was part of the expected gesture of the day, and she fitted herself to her place in it. Sometimes Janice had to go downstairs to the corner where some dark people named Vlamiki owned a little grocery. While she was gone, the father and daughter played. Their signs made jokes and they laughed often, saying silly things to each other. Margaret's signs came from Abel and Janice. Her fund of meaning was as poor as theirs, but her signs had the special beauty of her childhood, and Abel cherished even the mistakes she made. Sometimes he would tell them to Janice, smiling and shaking his head at the backward brush of a hand that changed a word into another, or dissolved the meaning of a sentence before his eyes. When Janice came, the playing always stopped, without anyone realizing that it had stopped just then. If she brought milk, Abel would wait until she was busy, and then, winking at Margaret, he would go to the bottle, untwist the evil and dangerous silver wire holding the pleated top cap. With his still black thumbnail, he would take off the cap and lift the tongue in the undercap to pull it up carefully for the undisturbed, thick coating of cream that lay clotted on the underside. This he would hand to Margaret, and she would smell the flowers and the clover that the cows had eaten. He would watch her, his lips moving sympathetically as she slowly licked the cream from the waxed lid. With it gathered on her tongue, she would breathe in and out as he had showed her, so that she could smell the flowers again from the inside. When Janice turned for the bottle, it was always there on the table, innocently capped, its wire removed, waiting to be opened, and their two faces hanging blandly in her direction. After dinner, the comforting mother hum of the machine would begin again, and Margaret and her father would wash up. Every Saturday, the work caps which Janice had finished had to be delivered to the factory, and a new stack of cut patterns gotten to take their places on the left side of her work table. After the mill delivery was made, the new work collected, and the money given, they would walk home through the loud, crowded streets, thick with people and smells, gaping with the gapes of fish peddlers, pushcart men, sellers of ribbons, cripples, rag collectors, and walking hawkers, and the flap mouth on and on. Children opening their jaws over carts of salt pretzels and fried cakes. Children silent screaming the food made by their mothers in the rank tenement kitchens. The alleys were always full of children. They seethed in the streets. Some delivered food or supplies in carts. Some escaped. Some were busy, some idle. On good days, the stores turned inside out also and moved their wares out on the streets, and there were always children hiding among the racked second-hand coats or among the stacks of pawned feather beds. Janice sniffed disgustedly at the filth of the children, even the small ones, sailing shoeboxes in the gutter. But even as she scolded, she knew there was no way to keep Margaret and Bradley away from the streets. They soon learned where the bullies lurked and where there was safety. They were quick to pick out the shadows of Caroli or Boo Boo from far up the block and to see whipping fragments of feared coats through the crowds of people. Very soon they learned the sound of Rabbit Nose Fanty's voice from 100 others. They developed the senses of soft-bodied nocturnal creatures, quickly there, quickly gone, disputing no inch of pavement for themselves, vowing no ice cream penny to ice cream. They hid what they had. When they could, they hid themselves. When they were caught, they fell fainting in the clutches of the tormentors, dissembled, broke away and ran to hide again, trembling in a stack of coats or behind the wheels of the ice wagon, their pulses beating with the hot, rapid tempo of birds. They spoke to save themselves. No more. When Bradley was old enough to speak and be understood by the street, Margaret broke him of signing there quickly and with the casual brutality of childhood. When she saw him with another boy, giving with confidence the familiar words he had at home, she pounced on him and beat him up. At 7, she could barely remember the first time she had signed outside and been ridiculed, told she was crazy, hooted away. Now, as she slapped again and again at Bradley's dumbstruck face, she screamed, "Keep your hands in your pockets!" She knew well enough what their true words seemed to people who could not read them. He had only been wishing aloud to his marble game friend, "If I had a cookie." His friend had looked at the patterning fingers glassily, uncertain of what he saw, but Margaret knew, though the sign was half formed. She broke from her own game and began to beat her brother, hating him for signing outside. That crazy string game without a string, that finger-fumbling drunk trick picture-making. After a time of confusion, he learned what Margaret had learned. That the true words, the mother-father words that comforted, spoke, and understood were an alien thing. And that in the world, only the risky, half-understood mouth-talk was allowed. The street and the world did not wish to trust or understand in the true and dependable way. Abel's term of apprenticeship had ended and his journeyman's time was over. He was a master printer. He could do lithography of all kinds. He could work in flat plate or offset, on a single or double press. His color work was careful, and he had mastered the duoblack, a process that gave to photography and art prints the greatest depth and contour, but which few men in the shop took the time and trouble to do. Yet the debt, reduced by a mountain, was a mountain still. He no longer took pride in the yearly building against principal and erosion of interest. Only gradually did it occur to him that in spite of the debt, he could, in a carefully limited way, be free. He was a good printer. That much he knew. He also knew that Mr. Webendorf saw him as a fool and a debtor, even after all the years. He had stayed with the shop because Mr. Webendorf said that nobody else would take on a deaf worker with a garnishment against him. Lately, however, there had been growing in Abel the small, hard knob of a wish to go out and try. It thrilled and frightened him. The prospect of another time of grappling with the world, with strange hearing. Over the years, he had seen that Webendorf's did not do the kind of printing that interested him. Once or twice, he had gone into bookshops on his way home and had seen fine magazines and picture books in duotone or duo black. Once, there had even been a display of someone's camera pictures magnificently photocopied. He remembered one especially, a group of sand dunes with late sun, the shadows making them seem almost like living bodies. The photographs were printed in duoblack, he was sure, but he was afraid to inquire what the pictures were or where they had been printed. They were fine work, though, he could see that. Someone, somewhere, was printing in a way that the men in his own shop gestured away with impatience, or made mouths at as if to say it was too good for them. He knew that Mr. Webendorf expected him to stay, always, perhaps as foreman leader or doing special jobs that came in. He had expected the same thing himself. But now he had begun to wonder at the number and variety of printed things. With all their talk and endless talk, words of mouth were not enough for hearing. And the words flowed onto paper and were to go on and on. He realized as he thought of it that, looking at a picture, he was the equal of a hearing. He went back to the bookstore every day until the pictures were taken down. Looking at them, he thought they could teach him what silence was. He was beginning to hate the grainy work he slammed out for handbills and newspaper ads. Now on the Sunday walks he took as an act of rebellion, dragging an unwilling wife and two complaining children, he would stop at newspaper kiosks to muse over the fine magazines, admiring the depth and artistry of the work, the richness of the color, and the variety those printers knew. Ignoring the cursing kiosk men, he would stand unruffled in their insults, studying the smooth pages. When he told his idea to Janice, she could see no sense in it. "You make $34 a month. The debt has to be paid. After that, we can go away from the dirty streets and poor people." "I only want to change to another place," he said. "Maybe no one will hire you. I will show them my work. It is good. They will try to cheat you. Hearing say one thing but mean another, they will cheat you."
"I think they do now a little."
"Yes, but in this place you know how they cheat and how much. In a new place you won't know. It's too much risk."
She was frightened.
He looked at her and was amazed. This was his gay, lively Janice, his Janice of the world, of outside, of travel and motion and newness. Now she stayed in the back room all day long, feeding mountains of cloth to her machine. Now she was afraid to go out on Sundays, anxious and irritated at the time wasted, money wasted, daylight wasted that could be moving, moving, moving under the needle.
It had happened without his noticing, so gradually and so reasonably that he couldn't tell when the anxious avarice had begun, or how it had managed to creep into the muscles and fibers of her body and the reaches of her mind and senses to dull and stiffen them. As he looked at his wife sitting sulking over coffee at the table, he saw that the few fast years of the machine had hunched her so that her dress pulled over her shoulders and lay loose in front. Her chest was sunken, her breasts shapeless in the dress. And for a moment he hated her for the defeats she had suffered by his debt. She saw him looking at her and sat up a little, but the neck and shoulders could not be so easily straightened. If anything, her trying made it worse.
"I don't want to talk about this anymore," she said, still frightened. "We have the delivery to make today." On Saturdays, they delivered the finished caps to the factory. Janice never saw Barbara or Mary there, but she was still afraid that somehow Abel would find out about them. The untruth, begun in the immediate animal efficiency of self-protection, was now overlaid with years of silence. It could never be explained or forgiven. It did not need to be. The world, after all, was hearing. What was not made into a word did not exist or have a meaning. She knew, for example, that although Abel nodded and accepted the pay envelope she gave him every week, he knew that she was keeping out as much for herself as she thought she could get away with. She kept money out, and he knew it. But since the word had not been made between them, the fact of it did not matter, wasn't there, couldn't hurt them. Habit shaped the week, and each Saturday Abel went into the sleeping room and took up the box of completed caps. Their number still surprised him. On the great squat idol they had moved across the single window where Janice worked, from the cloth to cap, and then to a heap of caps, more and more. He could hardly imagine the number of caps that were all the days. Every day of every week of every month of 5 years, a mountain of caps, a river of caps. For a minute, he had a picture of a city in which every man, woman, mother, child, doctor, lawyer, baby at the breast all wore one of Janice's caps. A piece of stiff cloth that had paused its last moment as cloth along her table, and then turned and gone through the needle, turned again, and come back as a cap. It made him feel dizzy. He knew the union was against such work and against the people who did it, and for a moment he thought he saw a reason. He had never thought about the unions or their reasons, but now everything he saw had a kind of doubt for him, asked him questions, changed. He stood waiting with the box, staring ahead, and then he realized that she was signing him to hurry. She picked up the slip on which she had written the number of thread spools and bobbins she had used and what she would need for the coming week. The children were downstairs waiting, old in the Saturday routine. Since Abel took Saturdays off to help Janice, Mr. Webendorf let him make up his time by adding an extra half hour each day of the week. He was glad today to be out, even for the routine walk and the heavy box, and the worry of taking the children with them. They were city children, careless of traffic and distracted by their hearing. It was a soft, shining day. They walked along happier than they had been at home. A surprising gift of sun and fresh wind flowing over the carts and people toiling in the street. The usual spring smells, rancid oil, urine from the alleys, damp plaster, poverty and rats, had been carried away somewhere. And from miles to the east, the smells of an ocean were being sent over the streets and houses. It came undeserved, like war or idiocy. They turned up the street to the corner and into an alley by the side of Lamiki's store. Margaret, pulling Bradley after her, went in through the back. By now, she didn't have to ask, but waited until she was noticed. The man who saw her did not speak, but turned and cried out to his ancient sister, "Hey, Julia, the dummies come for the cart." The woman pushed past her and went and got the little cart. She never spoke to Margaret, whom she assumed to be deaf and dumb also, but she did hold the door open as the girl struggled out with the cart. As Margaret left, she put the rental money neatly and carefully in the middle of the old lady's palm. Then she gave the short smile and thank you she had been taught, and pulled the cart through the door. It was good to get out of the dark back of that place and into the day. Abel put his large box into the cart, and Janice her two smaller boxes, and they began their walk. It was 8 blocks to the mill, but because of the cart, they were afraid to walk on the avenue, which was crowded with shoppers. Instead, they followed the alleys and side streets, and soon they had left the tenement blocks and were on streets of warehouses and wholesale businesses, which were now mostly closed for the weekend. Bradley was here and there, sniffing, scouting, peering into darkened windows, listening at dusty grills and coming away with the sides of his face blackened in a waffled pattern. When Margaret lost patience with him, Janice put him in the handcart, being careful of the boxes, and then Abel pushed him along while he crowed for the bumps. A block from the mill, they turned into another alley. This brought them to a side entrance around the corner from the main gate. They always went in the side door and took the freight elevator to the counting and inspection room. The checkers were busy, unsmiling women who took the work without greeting or expression. They counted, measuring every 50th and close inspecting every 20th, their faces set. No rejects this week. There seldom were. Janice took from them the card with her credits. After this, they had to go to the other side of the building and down a floor to where the cutting room was. The floor foreman there, in charge of piecework, checked the request slip and subtracted the machine rental and the new material and thread Janice was going to use from the money to be given from the credits. Then he gave her another slip with the amount she had made for the week. It always included the bonus, and he always smiled at her as if he noted her numbers with special pride. She liked his praise. Sometimes when the numbers were a little lower, she felt bad bringing the card to him, and though he never spoke to her, she felt that he alone knew and was interested in her numbers, the work into which all of her days were poured. He nodded now and handed her the card for her to take to the cashier. While he had been figuring, the cart was being packed with the new week's supplies. She noticed that the model was the one with the little tab in the back. They paid 25 cents more for every 10 caps when there was that little tab in back. Abel took the cart and they started down the hall to the elevator. They had to pick up the money at the cashier's desk and then they could go back home. This was usually the simplest part of the Saturday, but lately it had become the most difficult of all. For the past 5 or 6 weeks, as they got their money from the cashier's office, members of the union would come up to them arguing the union's case, pleading with each pieceworker there to stop taking work home. They would pick at the workers' sleeves, pushing against them. But none of the unions ever made clear words because their mouths opened so wide and their faces pushed and strained so much. Janice and Abel were frightened because they didn't know what the unions were saying, but they recoiled from the violence and passion on their faces and they felt shame for them, making a disgrace like that. The only way to leave from the cashier's office was by the front gate, and today when they reached the cashier, they saw that there were more of the unions waiting outside. Without being aware of it, the family tightened in close to one another and came together to the cashier's window. Two policemen were guarding the sour old lady in her henna wig. She took the card quickly and stamped it, and began counting out the money. When she handed the envelope through the grill window to Janice, she said something, so the riders smiled and nodded up and down hard, the way hearing expected, and turned from the window to go. Outside the front entrance was a little space and then the gate. They went to it slowly, pushing Bradley wide-eyed and still in the cart where Abel had put him. On either side of them, in a silence muzzy with vibrations that hurt inside their heads, people were pushing in close, their mouths gaping redly. They were past the gate, and among the people and fists were being shaken before Janice's face. All around them, eyes stared, faces hung, red and white with rage. Some of the women made moves to pull the cart away or to grab the bundles of pieces from it, but others held them back and they clawed and pulled the air in their own crude signs. In the cart, Bradley's face was making a howl of terror. The crazy unions started to follow them down the street, but someone else had come through the gate, and the people forgot them for the new one. Janice and Abel began to run as fast as they could, the cart flying ahead. When they saw the alley on the other side of the street, they ran into it quickly. From there, they went on, crisscrossing the dark web of alleyways, waking the drunks and the rats beneath the wheels of the careening cart. At last they stopped, trembling, and waited for their hearts to be still. Abel picked Bradley up and held him. Janice touched at her hair and straightened her dress. She was sweating and her face was very red. Her eye found Margaret, almost hidden behind her father's legs. The little girl was gray-white and shuddering uncontrollably. She must have heard. She must know the words. Abel put Bradley down so that he could speak. "You know what they said?" She ran against his leg and held it tightly, burying her face in the dark cloth and sobbing with fear. Above her, the parents looked at each other.
"What will we do?"
"I don't know. They are crazy. They want to take the cloth and they don't even know how to sew it."
"What do they want?"
His eye, too, found Margaret.
"She knows. She heard."
Janice went down on her haunches and began to pull Margaret's arms from around her father's leg. The little girl clung harder, sobbing until she was wrenched free and had to stand to face their questions.
"Tell us what they said."
"I don't know."
"You heard them. Tell us what they said."
Abel took Janice's arm. "Let's go home first. They may still be looking for us. She is frightened. Let's go home." The handcart was back at the store, and the week's pieces were piled in their Saturday order on the table, thread and bobbins in place. But the sound of the machine, the life of the house, was stilled. Instead, Margaret was sitting before her parents in the death quiet, her mind emptied by fear. They were waiting for her to speak. The words were a kind of magic to them. The words would reveal it all, would solve the mystery, would show them what to do. But what were the words? She searched for them again. They were hating words, unfamiliar words. One woman screaming, "You're taking bread from our children."
"They said we were taking some bread away from them."
"Do they think we have bread in the bundles? Do they think we are stealing the people's lunches?"
Abel moved his hands impatiently, muttering.
"Why should they say that?"
Janice demanded, her hands confronting Margaret with the difference between those words and the truth.
"I don't know, but I think it's really about the pieces," Margaret said,
not sure herself now why the woman had spoken of bread. Not for the first time had she found herself caught in words, unfamiliar and alone, not deaf, not hearing, aware vaguely and inexpressibly that the words, those holy rewards for which her parents were always straining, were at the same time fixed and not fixed, at the same time formed and loose. The same word could mean a real thing in the world or an idea, agreed on in secret, at a meeting to which everyone had been invited but her parents and herself. Armed with the secret laws, people walked the world, confidently sharing their knowledge. Is bread bread, or is it cloth? Janice persisted. Didn't they know it was pieces? Can you eat pieces? No. Why has that woman said we took bread?
I don't know.
And Margaret's sign went vague as she lost what little certainty she had. Abel put his hand on her head and said, Don't be afraid. It is a nice day today. Today we are not going to stay here and be afraid. Today, now, we all will go on the streetcar. I found out yesterday how to get to Deaf Church, and we are going to do it today. Janice began to argue. There was work to be done. Did he think she could make up today's work tomorrow? What would she wear? What would the children wear that didn't look ragged and make her ashamed? Back and forth the argument went, the two of them breathing hard in the stillness, clicking their teeth and lips, faces red and savage with anger, their hands shouting so loud that Margaret's head began to ache with the unmade noise. Don't you see? Abel was shouting. Pieces will be too dangerous. Pieces will soon be over, and what then? Who will help us? Who will know us? Will you die then? With a gesture of bitter disgust, he grabbed his wife's arm and began pulling her out the door. She hit out at him, punching at his neck and back and trying to wedge herself in the doorway. He hit her back from the door and then pulled her quickly through it. When she saw he was outside the apartment, she shook free with an ugly sign, made a face into his hard look, and began to slump sulkily down the stairs. Margaret and Bradley followed, frightened, hand in hand. Their parents' fights sprang up from nothing, were often violent, full of blows and loud guttural noises, fading quickly into something worse. A steady bitterness paced deep and slow, the better to last. 7. The streetcar ride had 3 changes. They rolled and shook down street after street of big stores and shops, streets of stone row houses all the same, past a park where they changed and went in another direction, down a long tree-lined avenue where the houses were all different, some wood, some stucco, some high-faced and thin, some low and squatting like fat old ladies. The family sat prim and still, their hands in their laps, their faces set. They were imitating some other family. As they passed the tree-shaded houses, Margaret wondered where all the people were. She was used to alleys full of wash and windows full of faces, streets surging with people, carts, noise, litter. Nothing hung between these houses. The windows stared emptily and hardly anyone was on the walks. A few children played here and there in what seemed to Margaret a forlorn and purposeless way. Now and then, someone would be seen walking carefully from somewhere to somewhere else. In the streets, there were cars and trucks, but no people. No carts, papers, rubbish, swearing men, or fighting children. The uncrowded spaces seemed immense, and the great trees stood over them, guarding, shading, silencing. The power and grandness of the trees flowed on to the houses and the people. The trees kept the houses secret and mysterious. That must be the difference between rich and poor. They got down to change cars, waiting on the platform in a band of sun glare. Smells of wonderful singleness hung all around them. Warm tar and cool trees. Horses, cars. The smells were not all mingled into one as they were on the street at home. Abel and Janice breathed in deeply. The children imitated them. The world outside was so quiet and mannerly, so prim and clean. Their streetcar came and they climbed up and began to move through yet another area of stores and traffic, and then past more houses. When they got down again, Abel led them across the street and then he looked around and motioned with his head. Up one block and then down another, and there was a big building. The church, he said. It was too early for them to go in. They walked slowly by it and back again. Abel seemed delighted with himself and everything he saw. Janice shot him a few sour glances, but he paid no attention. When the right time came, they went inside to the anteroom. Its walls protected them and made them feel freer to talk. Abel noted the sign saying, "Saturday, 3 p.m., mission to the deaf." After a while, some other people came. The women were beautifully dressed. They wore soft, clinging dresses like petals with patterns of summer flowers, and their handbags, hats, and shoes all matched. Some had white dresses, and then they wore white shoes and carried white handbags, and the white gleamed and shone as they stood talking. Margaret had never seen white shoes. It seemed strange that they should exist. The women were like flowers, and their scent made Margaret slightly sick and dizzy. Bradley had wandered away, but she was too fascinated to go and look for him. The anteroom of the church was filling up now, and everyone was busy talking, talking in near-perfect stillness. Now and then a laugh or a child's shout broke the loud silence, and there was the sound of feet moving and of softly draped bodies brushing against one another. No more. Margaret had been buried among the flowered backs and hips. When she looked around again, she could not see her parents. Slowly, she began to push her way toward the front of the room where she thought they might be. It was like swimming in a heavy, soft sand, yielding, unyielding, and for a moment she was afraid of drowning. Then suddenly she saw Janice and Abel standing together almost in front of her, although their faces were turned away so they did not see her. The sudden vision of them, unprepared, made her see them as though they were strangers. They were shockingly changed, barely recognizable. Her father looked rough and unkempt in his working clothes, her mother drooping, hard-faced and unpleasant. Of all the people crowding in that place, they alone looked hot, tired, and disappointed, like an unwelcome blotch, a mistake in the pattern of freshly washed, flowery women and neat, dignified men. Now and then, the parents would get a brief, impersonal greeting. The sign was decorous and educated. Margaret knew this, though she couldn't quite tell how. There were many signs she had never seen, and what she had seen, half-made and stunted, was given here with fullness and grace. She felt she had committed a sin, a terrible sin, to have seen her parents that way, as strangers. She went to them and tried to take their hands, asking in that gesture to belong to them, to be inside once more and part of them so that she would not have to look at them as a stranger looks. Abel motioned with his head for Bradley, and so she had to leave them again dutifully to look for him. Suddenly, the doors at the back were opened and people began to move into the sanctuary. Its magnificence took Janice's breath away. Rows of polished wooden benches faced the raised place where the minister would come. There were candles burning in great shining holders there and a gleaming golden cross against a purple velvet curtain. Everything was rich and shining, and the light of the candles was pale but steady in the daylight. People were sitting down in familiar places and greeting friends, everyone still talking happily in rich, fluent sign. She was frightened of going in there, where everyone seemed to know so much and to be so comfortable and familiar in his place. Abel and